From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Alwyn Nicolai, the choreographer who took Freudian symbolism out of dance and put unisex costumes in. His 40-year career was just honored with a Kennedy Center Life Achievement Award. Also today, we continue our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. We meet language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg. Country blues guitarist Moses Rasko performs a couple of songs. And Ken Tucker reviews the new home video release of the 1946 classic The Harvey Girls, starring Judy Garland and Ray Bolger. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is choreographer Alwyn Nicolai, who has made revolutionary contributions to the dance world. His 40-year career as a choreographer was recently honored with a Kennedy Center Life Achievement Award. Dancer Murray Lewis, who performed with the Nicolai Troupe for 20 years, refers to Nicolai as, quote, the only genius I've ever known. He took the theater art, which had become fractioned into painting, music, dance, and poetry, and pulled the pieces together to make a 20th century theater art, a theater art of abstraction, unquote. Nicolai describes his dance theater as an experience of movement, shape, sound, and color. Nicolai conceptualizes all those elements himself. He even composes his own music. He has pioneered many new visual techniques, such as projecting his own hand-painted slides onto the dancers' bodies. I spoke with Alwyn Nicolai earlier today, and I asked him to explain his credo that dance should be motion, not emotion.
Well, really, it came about through my trying to define dance. And I felt that there was a certain basic craft and skill to dance, similar to the painter's craft. For example, the painter's skill is the sensitivity and manipulation of color. And if he doesn't have that, he's going to be a poor painter. And of course, with music, it's the manipulation of sound. And I felt with the dancer, he should have a definition that was basic to him too, and that is the manipulation of motion. And motion, which had its own intelligence. It doesn't have to, let's say, qualify him or her or decorate the person doing it, but that within the gesture rests the intelligence of the intent.
When you were coming into your own as a choreographer, was there a lot of emotion as opposed to motion behind
yes.
the dances?
Oh, yes. Sturm und Drang, I think is what Oh, yes. It was the expressional period, and my study period was all through that. Of course, that started with Isadora Duncan way back in the turn of the century, 1900s. And from then until and through Graham, Martha Graham, the great high priestess that is really wonderful, wonderful dancer in person, the very strong emotional qualities were usually the content of their choreographic intent. And for instance, with Martha, it was the contraction and release, which was the agony and the ecstasy, really. And we were searching out at that time the inner feelings of common man, which was not a usual thing in dance at the turn of the century. And it started with Isadora.
And you didn't like Freudian interpretation of dance?
Oh, Freudian particularly, yes, in the latter day. It was very, very powerful. As a matter of fact, you had to be, you couldn't drag a string on stage without its being interpreted as an umbilical cord. And the three popular words in any review were fetal, phallic, and fertile. You know, these were the three things you almost always found in a dance review.
Well, dance was also very romantic, I think, in a lot of ways. A lot of dances
were
about courtship and
I think
sexuality.
All art is romantic. I think all, no matter you call it avant-garde, whatever it is, it's the romance of the human spirit, whatever you do.
But you moved away from the sexual courtship aspect of
yes.
the dance drama.
Yes, I did, yes, because I felt that had been really explored about as far as we could go at this present time in history. I think Martha Graham took it beyond Freud. Where Freud left off verbally, Martha took up and explored and communicated through dance.
I think most dancers were used to having male roles and female roles, and there were certain gender preconceptions that went along with that.
Oh, yes.
Was it hard for you to break your dancers of those ideas of what male and female dancers
did? But I had to do
did?
That. You see, what was interesting to me, too, and I think it's a very valid thing, because at that time, you know, sex was, as an exploration, was very dominant, but persons as such were not. In other words, I didn't want to look at a male or a female sexually. I wanted to look at them as people, as persons. I didn't feel I wanted to see them always in a state of, if I can be vulgar, a state of heat, you know. I wanted them, and I wanted to look at them and see that they had other desires in life than sexual ones. And so that I was anti-Freudian in that respect.
Well, to describe this, frequently your dancers are dressed in exactly the same costumes.
Oh, yes.
Of
yes.
Like a stretch fabric bodysuit.
Yes.
And you sometimes use dancers interchangeably. I've seen dances danced one time with a male in the role and another time with a female in the role.
Yes, there are many dances that can be done either by the male or the female. I brought the polarity much closer together. Back in 1953, I began that. But there are still roles that I think can be done only by a woman or by a man. But the reasons I cannot explain is just that I am still uncomfortable. Now, that may be just because of historical time and, you know, psychological time at this moment. Whether or not we'll overcome that, I'm not sure.
With what you just said about wanting to get some of the sexual heat out of dance and move on to other things, I want to quote something that Murray Lewis once wrote about you in an essay. It was really about sexuality in dance.
Yes.
And, he said that seeing the human form revealed in tights gave you two choices. You could either think dirty or come to grips with dance as an abstraction. And he said that that was a very difficult choice to make.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm wondering what it was like for you to try to get some of the kind of sexual heat out of dance at the same time you're working with young dancers and very revealing.
Who are in that, they're in that state. They're
exactly.
Either in puberty or, but that's a very interesting period, you know, because of, of course, if they remain in that period in their 35 or 40 years, of course, then they look kind of silly anyway. But I must say, for instance, children, I can't tell you up until what age, are very comfortable with abstraction. They don't have that sense of sexuality that comes, of course, when they get into actual adolescence. And then, of course, all sorts of hell breaks loose in their minds and their bodies. But I do think that working in this manner helps them to get over it with some sanity, you know. And they can still look at themselves as growing people rather than growing sex objects, you see. I thought this was very helpful. And it was out at the Playhouse. And Murray, incidentally, was an excellent teacher of that age group because he understood that very well. And you could see that they were people and not little sex pots, you know.
We know last night in a dance that I saw your company perform, in part of the dance, the everyone is topless, including the women.
Yes.
And but when it's time to take the bows, they end up putting on bodysuits. And I thought that was very interesting because for the dance, for the sculptural part, you wanted the body to be exposed.
Yes.
But it's a different relationship that the audience and the dancers have when the dancers are taking their bow. And for that part of the relationship, they were clothed again.
Yes. Well, there was a reason for that. The naked body takes on a luminosity in the slides that the material doesn't. And so really the purpose was not the nudity, but really the wonderful reflection that the skin tone forms as a screen for the projections.
My guest is internationally renowned choreographer Elwin Nicolai. I'm going to quote Murray Lewis again here, and this is about the early days that he spent with your company when it was still at Henry Street.
Yes.
And he said, most of us had little in common with each other outside of our devotion to Nicolai. We were black and white, tall and short, nervous and sedated.
That's true.
Heavy and thin, wiry and phlegmatic. Now, I mean, that's an example of you choosing dancers who didn't fit any one particular mode. mold. They were tall and short, fat, well, not fat and thin. I'm exaggerating. Well,
that was true,
but,
too.
Well, but I mean, you didn't...
Chubby, let's say.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's unusual for dance. You did not have this one particular mold that you wanted to find dancers to fit.
No, I still don't. I look for a quality. And as far as physicality is concerned, you don't want people who, you know, are freaks necessarily, but I think within the general range of human acceptance of the human form, I'll go along with that.
Do you think that ballet has too much idealized the body?
Not for it as an art, no, because its intent is different from mine. And I think, for instance, I loved ballet, Balanchine's idea of wanting to see the bones, and I still do like that. And I think we thought very much alike on several issues of that kind. But I think ballet is an entirely different kind of art, and that the requirements of it are different. But for modern, no. You have quality. And, you know, in those early days that Murray speak about when I was training the dancers too, they were all sizes and shapes and had different temperaments and so forth, but they were so well trained that their unison, an ensemble on stage, held them together. And, of course, this is what it should be.
Well, you know, that brings to mind something. I think that in your company you really emphasize ensemble performance over the solo virtuoso.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I didn't like the idea of stars. And, of course, I do have solos that come out and do their thing, but they also go right back into the chorus, or not the chorus, the group. And I like to say instead, they all are stars. And I think this was my nature of thinking, too. I don't want man to single out somebody as a star, but each one has his, you know, very special heritage and quality. And I think that's a part of the American thought, too, that your genes hold extraordinary information, and of course your interest in searching into them and expressing them is one of the wonderfulnesses of art.
Your dance combined sound, sculptural form, light, long before the word multimedia
was coined. Yes.
Now, you started projecting slides onto the dancers, and you've hand-colored the slides yourself.
Yes.
How did you come up with the idea of doing that? It works so well on stage. It's really quite remarkable
well,
to see.
Well, for one reason, at the Henry Street Playhouse, I had a stage. I had a beautiful little theater. It was in a remote part of town. I wasn't harassed by by certain things that were going on. I could isolate myself and do what the hell I wanted down there. And I was searching for a new definition of dance and came to the conclusion it was the art of motion. But then I discovered that in different colored lights, the motion looked different. Also, at that time, we couldn't go naked, but I wanted to really see the whole figure. So very often, instead of having a head stick out of a costume or the hands stick out from sleeves, I colored the whole body with strong, powerful light. So you looked at a total figure rather than a costumed figure. And this was in some particular pieces. And then, of course, accidentally, let's say there might have been some streak of some kind on the light that was projected, and I saw that when they passed through that, there was a different kinetics. So I began to design designs on slides that projected on the human body made a different value of kinetics. I easily explained, for example, if you're in a room with a window with strong sunlight and you have a Venetian blind, if the blind is pulled up completely and you put your hand through it, of course you see an arm going through slides without any great kinetic effect. But the minute you drop the blind and close and make little slats of light coming, then when your arm goes through, it goes, you know, it makes a very fast kinetic action. So I began to play around with that idea, kinetics as it became tempered by the light designs cast upon the body. And this interested me a great deal.
My guest is choreographer Elwin Nicolai. He's been a revolutionary force in the dance world for more than 40 years, pioneering the use of painting, slide projections, and poetry in dance performances. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Choreographer Elwin Nicolai is my guest. Now, you grew up in a small New England town. Were you exposed to a lot of dance or a lot of art when you were growing up?
Oh, heavens no. There was nothing like that. We weren't in any way in the area where one saw great paintings or heard great music, no. There was music at home, and we did have a record player. One of the wind-up kind at that time. I think one was an Edison. And we did have pieces. I know my mother liked opera, and we would have some of that, but not avidly. In other words, we weren't dragged off to events for culture. But there was a professor, piano, who came in once a week and ran through the whole family. That is not the whole one, my two sisters and me, 1 hour at a time. I was usually the last, and by the time he got to me, he would fall asleep. But some way or other, I managed to learn to play the piano fast and loud. And this was my way into music. And I was then a musician first, then, you see.
Well, that's interesting because you're still a composer. You compose the music for the dances that you create. So how were you actually introduced to dance?
I first played for silent movies, organ, not piano, not hinky-dink kind of organ, but, you know, very sophisticated organ. When I was 16 years old, I started that because of the depression. It was a wonderful experience for me because it lifted me right out of this small town and took me into the sophisticated areas of a city, or in this case, into the then very colorful art colony, Westport, Connecticut. And but, you know, you played for actors like Garbo and Swanson and those people in the later period because talkies hadn't quite taken over. But I learned to improvise on the organ. I improvised like a fool because I had to do it about 5 hours a day. But then, of course, talkies came in and I lost the job. And so I went back home and there, believe it or not, was a dancing school. And I went up and said, I have the skill of improvisation. Can you use me? And of course, Gloria Stanley, the teacher, said, why, of course. And so I began to play for dance. She, in turn, took me to New Haven, to the Schubert Theater. And Mary Wigman, the great German modernist dancer, was performing. I never saw dance. I never saw anything like this. And I saw this, and I fell in love with it, and I thought, this is what I wanted to do. So I found a woman who had studied with Wigman and taught in Hartford. And so I managed to get to Hartford to study with her, and then both of us went off to Bennington College, where they had those fabulous sessions with all the great modernists teaching, Graham, Humphrey, Wideman, Holm, Horst, John Martin, the early critic of the New York Times, all in a state of really wonderful, hysterical excitement about the new American art, modern dance.
When you were starting to dance, did you go through what I think a lot of young men in dance have gone through over the years, and this fear that you would be considered effeminate, you know, quote-unquote, because you danced?
Yeah. Yes, that sissy stuff was very prevalent, and, you know, you almost were ashamed to say you were a dancer. I remember I would avoid it by saying, well, I'm in the theater, you know. I didn't want to explain. As a matter of fact, I still have some of that carried with me. I know sometimes on plane when all of us are together and somebody will be very curious about what we do, and I very often found somebody sitting next to me and saying, well, I'm very curious. What is it you do? So we have a joke amongst us. We say, "Oh, well, we're funeral directors, and we're going to a conference," and you know, this shuts them up very fast.
Well, you took a break from your dancing career to be in the Army during the Second World War.
I was invited by the government.
Right. Yeah. So now there's a few places more macho than the Army. How did you deal with it then?
Well, you know, I had a choice because the doctors discovered I had a heart murmur, which wasn't serious, but they said I could stay out. But I thought, no, I wanted to go in. I wanted to find out, you know, what the hell this machismo business was and did I fit into the scheme. And I discovered I held myself up very well in terms of bravery, substance, and, moral kind of behaviorism and all that sort of thing very well.
So that helped you overcome that feeling.
It helped me very much. Oh, yes. I didn't worry about that anymore.
When you started to put together what became your own company when you were at the Henry Street Theater in New York, was it hard to find dancers who were interested in modern dance and especially in your vision of modern dance?
No, because it was an indigenous art to the United States, and it had begun to take hold, and people came to it. And we didn't have the fantastic urge and sort of elitist focus towards ballet that we now have. And so although we were homespun, we were damn good. And it's very interesting because European countries recognize that, and before long we were invited to perform in Europe, and we very highly respected in Europe. Now, of course, I mean they see Giselle Swan Lake very easily there, and have for generations and so forth. So it was a great relief to see modern dance, and so we became a very strongly wanted export product. Still are.
Did you realize pretty early on that it was going to be your calling to be a choreographer as opposed to a dancer? Because it's really as a choreographer,
yes,
not as a dancer that you really
not
need
to
name.
Early on. But I must say there was one teacher I had, Louis Horst. He was Martha Graham's music director, but he taught choreography. And, oh, God, he was hellish to study with because he was so absolutely strict and he didn't like men very much. And his tongue was vitriolic, and you got it right and left. And if you could stand him, however, then you emerged, out of the drop forgery of the art, because he was so perceptive of your skill in motivation, which then took place in emotional form through your skill. And he would call even on the finger lifting, on the eighth measure and beat three, he would say, "Why did you do this?" And I discovered I could do this. And when I found out through him that I had the capabilities, then and there I decided I was going to be a choreographer.
Dancers and choreographers are so aware of their bodies and attuned to it and have such beautiful bodies. I'm wondering if getting older and the changes that age brings to the body have affected you more than you think they affect the average person. I don't mean that you're aging quickly, the opposite,
yes,
of that, but that you'd be more, feel worse about losing some of the suppleness of the body because such a good one.
It's, as I got older, I discovered, I developed a skill of verbalization and in directing. And so I do this very well now. So I make token gestures, really, when I choreograph, but my dancers pick it up very quickly. I think one of the most remarkable examples is Murray Lewis, who at 61 now is still one of the greatest virtuoso dancers of our time in modern dance, particularly. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But exquisite detail, my gosh, and he has these stunning dancers in his company that athletically bound and seem to be able to levitate, and yet Murray comes out and with his artistry can immediately command the audience's attention entirely away from them. It's incredible. So I think one, as a performer, gets richer And modern dance allows that. You see, ballet doesn't. You always have to be a prince or a princess. I know there's a crazy story Murray tells when he was doing some things for Rudolf Nureyev, and Rudolf was concerned about this, and he can swear wonderfully. He was in his dressing room pounding, and Murray said to him, "Well, Rudolf, you have to learn now to dance like a man rather than a boy." And see, ballet almost always demands that you must dance as a boy. Modern dance doesn't make that demand. You can dance as a man or a woman.
That's a really interesting distinction.
Yes, yeah, it's wonderful. And we often thought, my God, if you took, Dame Margot, for example, and she still moves beautifully, but she cannot do those athletic young princess roles anymore, but she, choreographed by a modern dancer, she could still be wonderfully beautiful.
Well, I remember Merce Cunningham telling me that as he got older, he started choreographing more things that used his arms. Because he didn't require the kind of athleticism that he thought he wouldn't be able to do. Your company and the Murray Lewis Company are collaborating now, and your dancers are performing his works, and his dancers are performing your works.
Yes.
Do you think you're all learning a lot about each other by this trade-off?
Yes, I think we are. And also, each Murray's company is eager to work with me, and my company eager to work with Murray's, because Murray's attack is entirely kinetic and mine is strongly visual, but both of us demand things that are slightly different and they want to be challenged that way. And they're doing very well. They're doing very well with it.
For years, since the 50s, you've traveled around the United States at least once a year with your company.
Oh, often. More often sometimes, yes.
Just briefly, what's the equivalent of badly tuned pianos? In other words, when a pianist travels, he has to or she has to cope with a badly tuned piano. What does a dancer have to cope with or what do you have to cope with the lights and sound too when you're traveling around the country?
Well, the things that are uncomfortable to dancers are bad floor, number one, temperature. I think those are the two things that make their life difficult. And food. So you have to be careful that these are three items that are well taken care of.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so let me ask you this quickly.
Okay.
You have the reputation of being an excellent cook.
That's for therapy.
This is the worst kind of temptation a dancer would want around. Dancers like to eat very little and keep very trim. You must drive your dancers crazy with the dishes you prepare.
No, because I think most of them are good cooks because we were all very poor at one time. And so you have to learn, if you like food, to prepare that which you like. And it becomes now, for me, a therapy. You can only do one thing when you cook, and that is cook.
Ellen Nicolai, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
My guest has been choreographer Ellen Nicolai, who just received a Kennedy Center Life Achievement Award, and that's one award added to many, many that he's received from around the world over the years. This week and next, his company is performing at the Joyce Theater in New York City along with the Murray Lewis Company, and the Nicolai Company is also performing in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with comedian Dennis Miller. He anchors the Weekend Update news feature on Saturday Night Live. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Linguist, noun, someone who studies language. That's what the dictionary says. Coming up, we ask our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, how he defines what he does. It's another in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Also, country blues guitarist Moses Rasko performs a couple of tunes, and critic Ken Tucker reviews The Harvey Girls, the 1946 classic starring Judy Garland and Ray Bolger. It's now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Stock prices plunged on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 140 points to 1911.31, wiping out all of the gains posted this week. It's the third largest point loss in history. Declines led advances 15-1 on volume of 204 million shares. A presidential commission today recommended a new federal regulatory system to prevent another collapse like the October stock market crash. The panel, headed by former Senator Nicholas Brady, also calls for coordinating trading halts on the various stock and commodity markets in the country. Brady denied today that the report would result in creating greater government involvement in the markets.
We're talking about putting control of margins, for instance, in which is spread throughout the system in one agency. There's also the question of what we call circuit breakers. Put that in one agency. Try to get the information centralized. Have a unified clearinghouse. That just makes sense. There are three clearinghouses in Chicago and one in New York now. I just think it makes sense to put them all together.
The commission was set up specifically to look into the causes of the October crash. It focused mostly on the mechanics of the stock exchanges in New York and the Chicago options markets rather than broad economic policy. The nation's unemployment rate in December fell to its lowest point in 8 years. The Labor Department reported today unemployment last month fell to 5.8%, down 0.1% from the month before. The economy experienced big gains in employment in the service, manufacturing, and construction industries. Conference Board Vice President Ed Fiedler says the lower unemployment rate is surprisingly good news.
It's really quite extraordinary how much strength the economy continues to exhibit month after month in the wake of the disaster on Wall Street last October.
Overall, more than 103.5 million civilians held jobs in December, an increase of 325,000 jobs over November. A water emergency closed schools and businesses in Steubenville, Ohio today as a huge fuel oil slick made its way down the Ohio River. Water intake valves were shut down and the Ohio National Guard began delivering water by truck to Steubenville's 26,000 residents. Downstream in Wheeling, West Virginia, officials prepared to close that city's water treatment plant at the first sign of contamination. Ice in the Ohio River has slowed the progress of a huge diesel fuel spill from the nation's worst inland oil spill. There was more rock and tear gas throwing in Israel's occupied territories today. Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian demonstrator during a disturbance that followed Friday prayer services at a mosque in Gaza. Iraq said its warplanes bombed an Iranian oil refinery today, the seventh day of a lull in Persian Gulf shipping attacks. Meanwhile, Pentagon Chief Frank Carlucci continued his tour of the embattled region, as Lou Miliano reports.
Secretary of Defense Carlucci has ramped up his fifth day here to the Gulf with visits to this ship, the minesweeping helicopter carrier Okinawa, and to the mother ship, the Mount Vernon, for the minesweeping boats, with a statement the threat in the Gulf to shipping is no longer mines. And while he refused to say a decision's been made to let this carrier rotate out of the Gulf without a replacement, he did say the threat and the force here are under constant evaluation. And should there be a change...
Nobody should read any political significance into that.
A message, it appears, more directed to moderate Gulf states, reassuring them the U.S. isn't cutting and running. I'm Lou Miliano on board the USS Okinawa in the Gulf.
The storm that blanketed the southeast with snow yesterday moved up the eastern seaboard today and headed to New England. 9 inches of snow in the nation's capital forced the government to shut down. State offices were closed in Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For this week's performance spot, we've invited Moses Rasko. Although he's a new name on the country blues circuit, Rasko has been singing and playing guitar for nearly 60 years. As a teenager during the 1930s, he performed for drinks in speakeasies and after-hours joints down south. In the 40s, when he started driving a truck for Allied van lines, Rasko stopped playing for a living. But while on the road, he always traveled with his guitar and frequently played for other truckers. 5 years ago, Moses Rasko retired from his long-distance trucking job and began performing again. He recently recorded his first album. We asked him to visit our studios and share a couple of tunes.
I started playing country and western when I was 13, but I always wanted blues, but my people wouldn't let me get out of nothing. So I had to go by the book. That when I ordered a guitar, they sent me a country and western book. I'd learned to play country and western then, but I always wanted blues. People showed me a few notes and a few runs, and from there I went on for myself trying to find something extra to throw in. So I guess that's about all I can say about myself, and I'll just stick with the blues. And the country blues is that. I don't do no city blues. I guess I'm too old and too slow for the feed up for the city blues. So here we go with that Stagger Lee now. Lord, I was standing on the corner when I heard my bulldog bark. I swear he's barking, that is two men gambling in the dark. To Stagger Lee and Billy, two men who gamble late. Stagger Lee throws seven, Billy swore he throwed eight. Stagger Lee told Billy, Billy, I just can't go for that. You don't want all my money and my brand new stairs on that. Stagger Lee went home and he got his 44. Say he's gone to the barroom, paid that daddy off. Stagger Lee went into the barroom, stood 4 feet from the door. Didn't know one scene when he pulled his 44. Stagger Lee found Billy. Billy says, please don't take my life. I got three little children and a very sickly wife. Stagger Lee shot Billy, and he shot that boy so fast. I swear the bullet went through him and it broke my whiskey glass. Now if you don't believe that Billy's dead, if you don't believe he's dead, just count the holes in his head. I played the blues, and then when I get a little fed up and blues kind of get to me, then I always started these some fast songs that I'd get my mind off the blues, and I'm going to try a little Scooby-Doo for you this time. I mean I want a Scooby-Doo, baby want Scooby-Doo-Doo. You hear me, honey, talking that old Scooby-Doo, baby want a Scooby-Doo-Doo. I woke up this morning, 4:30, body knocking on my back door. My little old sweet mama, she must have wanted Scooby-Doo with her daddy. Baby wanted Scooby-Doo. I know the girl, she been Scooby-Doo doing. Yeah, she been Scooby-Doo doing. You hear me, honey, talking that old Scooby-Doo-Doo. Lord, I want Scooby-Doo-Doo.
in the morning, baby, it won't be long. Call God knows and I'll be gone. Miss your loving sweet papa, baby from Scooba-Doo. Somebody else, baby from Scooba-Doo. I mean I want to Scooba-Doo, baby want a Scooba-Doo-Doo. You and my honey talking that old Scooba-Doo-Doo, Lord I want a Scooba-Doo-Doo. I woke up this morning, 4:30, body knocking on my back door. My little old sweet mama, the baby want a Scooba-Doo. It's her daddy, baby want a Scooba-Doo. I know the girl, she trying Scooba-Doo-Doo, she want to learn Scooba-Doo-Doo. You and baby talking that old Scooba-Doo-Doo, mama trying Scooba-Doo. Baby right foot in, left foot out, trying mama move your body about. And that's your loving sweet ways, hey Lord, that's way Scooba-Doo. With your daddy, baby way to Scooba-Doo.
We'll hear more songs from Moses Roscoe next week. This is Fresh Air. From time to time, we're featuring interviews with our contributors who regularly comment on music, films, books, popular culture, and language trends. Today, we'd like to introduce you to our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg. Each week, Jeff talks about common expressions and changes in our language and puts it all into a social and political perspective. On Fresh Air, he's discussed subjects ranging from the overblown language in our national anthem to 60s jargon that has survived into the 80s and his own personal struggle with wording the outgoing message on his telephone answering machine. Jeff is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the American Heritage Dictionary. I asked him to describe the role of a linguist.
Linguists are people who think about language all out of proportion to what language requires, perhaps. They're people who are obsessively interested in language, the way language is used to communicate, the history of languages, the underlying structure of languages that people mostly learn without even having to think about it.
A lot of people assume that linguists see themselves as the enforcers of the language, the people who make sure that you're using proper usage and things along those lines. I don't think that's how you see yourself by any means.
No, I think that's a terrible misconception. Linguists, for the most part, are really not interested in questions of good usage. Actually, I am, but I'm odd for a linguist in that way. Most linguists think that language is so deep and so basic and learned so early that the things the grammarians get after, the sapphires and the simons, really are just superficial things that really don't matter.
Yeah, so how do you feel about the people like Edwin Newman and William Sapphire, who almost see themselves as defenders of proper usage and defenders of the English language as we know it?
Yeah, I think that it's a terrible, awful, oppressive way of thinking about language. It really gives the language a bad name. It becomes a club for hitting people over the head. I'm cultured, I'm sophisticated, I know all these things and you don't. And it's really an awful way to turn people off language and to make people think that language is in some way a minefield rather than just a wonderfully interesting field for study and lucubration.
Luca who?
Lucubration. Reflection. I don't know.
What got you interested in and even obsessed with the English language?
You know, I really don't know. A lot of linguists are people whose parents spoke another language or who had some curious experience moving from one country to another when they were kids. But I just grew up in New York City, and I don't know where I got it from, but I had it all my life. It wasn't until later in my life that I realized that that was what I actually wanted to do.
Well, growing up in New York, you were probably surrounded by a lot of really interesting ethnic dialects, regional accents, foreign languages. Were you aware of that when you were growing up?
I think so. New York's a wonderful place for that sort of thing. So is Philadelphia. Out here on the West Coast, actually, I sometimes miss the wonderful accents. Here it seems like everything's homogenized and come to rest by the Pacific.
What are some of the things that you did along the way before becoming a linguist?
Oh, my. Well, I went to college, and I dropped out of college and went to art school, and I realized there that I was basically a word person. I went back to college. I took a wonderful course in linguistics, and I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do.
So you dropped out of college to go to art school. It's interesting you drop out of one school to go to another school.
Yeah, I know. Even then, I was clearly written for an academic life. I was going to art school, and I was writing for magazines like We Magazine and Screen Stars and Screen Gems and things like that, and... And at that point, I realized I was a lot better at writing and words than I was at art. So,
someone told me that you used to write for soap operas. Is that true?
I don't know where you found out about that. I wrote a soap for NBC for about a year. That was back in the days. We just thought it was sleaze. We didn't know it was politically incorrect to write those things.
Now you know.
Yeah. Now we know better. Yeah.
Well, when you were writing soap operas and when you were writing for the screen magazines,
right?
Did you start writing in a language that you didn't really speak, that you weren't really used to using?
I can remember trying very hard to get Middle American language at that time, and we had a rule on those shows that you could use a line only three times. So, Steve, I'm going to have your baby. You're going to have my baby. I'm going to have your baby, and then you couldn't say back, "I'm going to have your baby."
You would do things like that to fill time in the soap
opera? To fill time, sure, sure. What? Who knew?
Right. One of the things that you do now as a linguist is monitor new expressions and keep track of how slang expressions from the past are holding up. Have you ever indulged in speaking slang yourself? In the 60s, for instance, did you use terms like far out and chick and dude and crash and split?
Yeah, all but dude, I think. Oh, yeah, yeah, I used slang, and I use slang now, and I think slang is terrific. It's hard to follow now. I have a friend who keeps me up on what's going on in the high schools and tells me that Burnouts is moving out in favor of Punk or Jellyhead and so on, but it's really hard to keep up with.
You must be very self-conscious, though, when you add a slang expression to your vocabulary, because you're doing it more consciously than, say, a teenager who's coming of age would do it. Teenagers tend to naturally add new words to the vocabulary like that.
Well, I think they're pretty self-conscious about it, too. I can remember when I was going to high school, we had about 78 words for breast. And most of these words existed solely so that we could have all these different words for breast. We use them in this very self-conscious way. I don't think anybody ever used them in earnest.
Do you ever groom your vocabulary to weed out the slang expressions that you think have gotten too dated?
No, in fact, sometimes I groom it the other way. I think, oh, gee, this is a terrific, let's bring back swell, or let's bring back nifty. Right, nifty's a great word.
Now, one of the hats that you wear is usage editor of the American Heritage Dictionary.
Oh yeah.
Which means what? That you're the one who oversees the description of how a word is going to be used in a sentence.
Or how which words are correct and incorrect and what's proper and improper. All those things that I was calling oppressive a few minutes ago. We have a panel of about 150 writers that range from Louis Auchincloss to Francis Fitzgerald to Cynthia Ozick. And we send them a questionnaire. Well, I've just been making up these questionnaires, in fact, and ask them, well, what do you think of this word? We just ask them, for instance, about Holocaust. How do you feel about using Holocaust to describe AIDS or a burning building or what happened in Cambodia? And we'll get their reactions and then put those into about 500 usage notes that the dictionary contains.
So are you monitoring what people are already doing and using that as your usage note, or are you making new rules for what people should
both.
Be doing?
You can nowadays it's very easy because you've got all these database systems, so you just plug in a word that you're interested in, like moot was a word I was interested in the other day, and I just plugged it in, and I got about 500 citations for moot. But then what we're interested in is how people feel about that usage. You get something like impact as a verb, which a lot of people hate. So we either ask the panel, or we just say, you know, a lot of people don't like this word.
At the end of each of your commentaries, I announced that you're a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. I'd really like to give you the opportunity to tell us what you do at Stanford.
Well, what I do at that institute and at another research institute I'm involved with is study a couple of things, sociolinguistics, which is the relationship of language to society. And there I do in a kind of technical way some of the things that I talk about in the commentaries I do on Fresh Air. And I also do work in semantics, just the study of meaning.
If someone where you teach uses a pointless bureaucratic expression, the kind of expression that you would criticize in one of your commentaries, would you mention that to them, or do you just make a mental note of it and store it away to comment on at some future date?
I spend a lot of time scribbling things down and saying nothing and bringing them up at some future date. One of the nice things about being able to do these commentaries is I get to let off steam about all these expressions without actually addressing anybody personally, which I think is slightly rude.
Do you find yourself judging people by how they speak?
Well, I find myself paying a lot of attention to the way people speak, often much to the distress of my wife and close friends. But I don't know if I judge people, unless they use impact as a verb. But you can tell a lot about people from their accent, from their pitch and intonation, from their just the way they put things. Look, I was in Hermes yesterday in San Francisco, and there's a fella standing at the counter there, and he says, how much would these scarves be? Not how much are these scarves, but how much would these scarves be? Now, this is a guy who knows that these scarves are going to cost a lot more money than he's prepared to spend, and who also knows that, or who also wants to give the impression that he's undisturbed by these prices. It's little things like that, just listening to the use of a what we call a modal verb, like would or something, that really tip you off about people and attitudes, if you listen.
Okay. Well, Jeffrey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Fresh Air's language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg spoke to us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're covering some problems that some Republican presidential hopefuls have. Senator Dole and Alexander Haig both have campaign staffers whose papers have been seized by the FBI in Texas today, some allegations of election fraud. They would have been ganging up against George Bush. We hear from news analyst Daniel Shore about the vice president's problems in explaining just what he knew and when he knew it about the administration trading arms for hostages. Also, three experts assessed the policy of escorting Kuwaiti tankers through the Persian Gulf now that it's been our policy for the past several months.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ken Tucker has a review of a new home video release of a Judy Garland film from the 40s, The Harvey Girls. It won an Academy Award for Best Song and co-starred Ray Bolger, who played the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz 7 years earlier.
Although it's weighed down with the soggiest premise imaginable, The Harvey Girls is one of the zippiest movie musicals ever made. This MGM spectacular featured Judy Garland as a 19th-century mail-order bride who finds herself on a train heading west with a carload of waitresses. These are the Harvey girls of the title, who are being dispatched to serve in a New Mexico restaurant. Really makes you want to run out and rent it, doesn't it? What the Harvey girls lacks in high concept, however, it makes up for in high spirits. Judy Garland and Ray Bolger lead a big cast through a bunch of razzle-dazzle songs by Johnny Mercer and Harry Warren, and the movie hits a delirious peak early on with On the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
All aboard, she's on her way.
Smoke rising round the bend. I reckon that she knows she's gonna meet a friend. Folks around these parts get the time of day.
from the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Here she comes.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Hey, Jim, you better get the rig.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
She's got a list of passengers that's mighty big.
And they'll all want lifts to Brown's Hotel. Cause lots of them been traveling for quite a spell. All the way from Philadelphia, on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
That song, performed as Judy and the Harvey Girls dangle out of a moving locomotive, is one of the most widely hailed scenes in American musicals. Seeing how gracefully the number was staged and filmed by director George Sidney, you understand why musicals were the ultimate escapist fare of the 40s. The best of them featured great performers doing perfectly unbelievable things with beguiling nonchalance. The bright colors of the Harvey Girls transfer well to the TV screen for its video cassette version, but I'd be fibbing if I said that a great scene like the Atchison, Topeka sequence loses nothing in moving from the big screen to the small one. Some of its grand sweep is inevitably lost, but the Harvey Girls is still an enchanting piece of well-crafted foolishness. Watch for Sid Charisse in a small part as one of the Harvey Girls, and note how stiffly John Hodiak moves as Garland's putative romantic interest. And you whippersnappers who know Angela Lansbury only as the little old lady detective on Murder, She Wrote, will have your socks knocked off when you see her here as a sexy dance hall queen. Other new video releases include Roxanne, Steve Martin's updating of Cyrano de Bergerac, and Hollywood Shuffle, director-comedian Robert Townsend's sharp satire on the plight of black actors in the movie world.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's Garland and Kenny Baker in another song from the Harvey Girls, March of the Dogies.
And nobody asking you why, give me a call and song, and I'll be getting along.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with photographer William Claxton. In the 50s and 60s, he was often a fixture at recording sessions and jazz clubs, and his photos from these years have been collected in a new book titled Jazz. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Pop Bop, the new album from alto saxophonist Richie Cole, and television critic David Bianculli will review a new syndicated series featuring Mr. T. It's called TNT, and David says it's not as dynamite as the title suggests. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.